Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed welcomes Drs. Sukru Emery and Mario Strasabusco. Dr. Emery is a professor of transplantation and chief of transplant surgery at Yale New Haven, and Dr. Strasabusco is a professor of internal medicine focused on hepatology.
How many patients are diagnosed each year with this disease?
Liver cancer is a worldwide problem. Its incidence is estimated mortality annually is above 600,000 people worldwide. The incidence varies according to geographical areas, and this is due to the different incidence of the risk factors, of course. So if it is very extremely high in Asia and some parts of Africa and some Mediterranean country, is less frequent in Western countries like USA. However, it is in the, is raising even here.
So Mario, just to give us a sense, so about how many patients would you say are diagnosed with liver cancer in the United States?
So in the United States, we have a mortality of 7,000 people per year, and a prevalence, which means the number of patients that are sick, of 18,000. Mm-hmm. And in Connecticut, from where we speak, actually, statistics performed around 5 years ago show that there are at least 180 deaths per year due to liver cancer.
So it's a pretty significant disease.
It is indeed.
And Sukru, I guess there's now this appreciation that the incidence of liver cancer, certainly here in the United States and I guess in some other, you know, Western countries, is steadily increasing. And I know some of the numbers that are projected out to 10, 15 years from now are pretty staggering. And why is that?
Well, that the increasing number of persons living with cirrhosis is likely explanation for the increasing incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma, resulting from a combination of factors, including increasing incidence of cirrhosis caused by hepatitis C cirrhosis, to a lesser extent hepatitis B infection, and a general improvement in survival among cirrhotic patients. It has been estimated that hepatitis C began to infect large numbers of young adults in North America and South and Central Europe in the 1960s, 70s as a result of intravenous drug use. So that the virus then moved into national blood supplies and circulated until a screening test was developed in 1990. After which time, rates of new infection decreased dramatically. Currently, it's estimated that HCV-related HCC will peak around the year 2010, next year. Mm-hmm. So if I summarize, and we are making the people survive with hepatitis-related cirrhosis. That might be hepatitis C, hepatitis B, alcoholic liver cirrhosis, hemochromatosis. All these the cirrhosis, whatever the underlying etiology, sets the stage that the liver cells then can change their regular rhythm, and then they develop cancer. So since we are surviving longer, and then we are going to see more and more hepatocellular carcinoma.
Okay.
That one more thing, and I would like to say here, that our estimate is, and after the diagnosis and cirrhosis in hepatitis C patients, within 5 years, approximately 25% to 30% of the patients will develop hepatocellular carcinoma.
Okay. Mario, you had something to say?
In fact, Sukru raised two very important points. Number one, countries, this cancer rarely happens in patients without liver cirrhosis. It's mostly a consequence of a chronic liver disease. And the second point that Sukru raises is that it takes a long time to go from the hepatitis to cirrhosis, to cancer. So we estimate that this time can be between 20 and 30 years. And this is why we are seeing now the cohort of the patient that got infected 20 years ago, before we started to use the interferon and other antivirals, and had the time to develop cirrhosis.
Okay.
And this is why we project that in the next 10 years, the incidence will raise even more.
And again, maybe we can just review for our listeners, what are the main causes for the chronic liver disease, cirrhosis that you talk about, which then leads to liver cancer?
Right. So every kind of cirrhosis may ultimately lead to liver cancer, although there are differences. Some etiologies are more closely related. For example, hepatitis B. Hepatitis B virus is an oncogenic, direct oncogenic virus, can integrate into the DNA and favor the expression of pro-oncogenes.
If I add that, you know, the in the United States and Europe, and main reason is hepatitis C, and in the Asia and Southeast part of the world is hepatitis B followed by hepatitis C, and this other thing is on the chemicals such as alcohol and aflatoxin. We don't see aflatoxin related hepatitis HCC in this country, and very rare. And also we have hormones such as exogenous steroidal sex hormones, and we have cirrhosis related to metabolic diseases such as tyrosinemia, such as primary hemochromatosis, alpha 1 antitrypsin, and of course the diseases and will be affected, and there are other factors modulating this, such as sex, such as age and race, that will be affecting increasing the or decreasing the number of hepatocellular carcinoma cases.
Now, for a long time, it was felt that in this country, in the United States, that alcohol-related liver disease, cirrhosis, was really the main reason for liver cancer. Mario, your thoughts on that?
As we said, all possible causes of liver disease, if left untreated, will lead to the cancer. But there is an important point to make here, that most often patients that progress to cirrhosis and then to cancer have more than one risk factor. Is the association of different risk factors that increases dramatically the relative risk. So if you have hepatitis C, you don't know it, okay? And you drink socially, and maybe, you know, you eat and you are overweight, your risk of having cancer increases dramatically. If as many patients that acquire the viruses when they were maybe using IV drug when they were younger and they have a co-infection, hepatitis B and C, even if the hepatitis B has been longly non-active, their risk of infection increases dramatically. And now we have another player coming into the game that surprises all of us, which is fatty liver. And steatosis, and with Sukru and I are seeing more and more of these patients.
And that's a consequence of obesity?
Yes, of the metabolic syndrome.
Okay.
That is correct.
So just in terms of, what age group is at highest risk for developing liver cancer?
Well, the based on our estimation, and then as Mario indicated, that after receiving or contracting the disease and viral diseases, development of cirrhosis, and for example, for hepatitis C, takes somewhere around 20 years. And after you develop cirrhosis, development of HCC takes time, and maybe 5 to 7 years more. So that we are thinking about, just the development of cirrhosis, the HCC takes 25 to 30 years. If we assume that they contract the disease somewhere in teenagers and 15 to 20 years of age, our population mostly age somewhere around 45 to 55 range, and we are seeing the HCC more.
Okay. And then what are the typical symptoms associated with liver cancer? You know, what should people look out for in terms of symptoms?
Unfortunately, when you have symptoms related to liver cancer, your cancer is very advanced. So what you actually ought to do is to take good care of your liver And your doctor should be able to identify the risk factors that you may present, mm-hmm. so that the possibility of a cancer has to be sought after. Because if you can see the cancer when it's small, there are many things that can be done. If you wait until the cancer causes a portal vein thrombosis or ascites, most often.
And ascites, maybe just define ascites for our audience, Mario.
It's the presence of fluid in the peritoneal space in your abdomen, uh-huh. outside.
So
of
their
your
belly
belly
would get a little bit bigger,
right.
and uncomfortable.
Yes, uh-huh. yes, progressive okay. increase of abdominal girth.
Uh-huh. I would like to add a couple of things in what Mario said, and right, that is true that, you know, if cancer gives symptoms, and which means that it's very extensive disease, and that might be some dull abdominal pain. Sometimes we can see development of jaundice or yellow eyes, and that can be seen sometimes, and extreme pain can occur. And we do see ascites, or the accumulation of the fluid in the abdominal cavity, secondary to the cirrhosis, not related to the hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer. And if someone doesn't have a cirrhosis and development of ascites can be attributed to development of hepatocellular carcinoma. It's the point we are making here. The as Mario said, then we have to look after these patients very carefully, monitor them. I'm talking about cirrhotic patients, mm-hmm. because we do know that sometime along the course of cirrhosis, they are going to develop hepatocellular carcinoma. So that the screening programs, and they are the extremely important in order to diagnose hepatocellular carcinoma early, that we can do something about that before cancer goes out of our hands and spreads all over the body. That is our aim at this point, and while we are dealing with cirrhotic patients. Mm-hmm. Just to follow them very carefully, probably every 3 to 6 months, imaging studies and sending the what we call tumor markers or alpha fetoprotein, which is the specific tumor marker for hepatocellular carcinoma, sending those the tumor markers. And if we see any imaging study and consistent with hepatocellular carcinoma, obtaining liver biopsies and seeing. And meanwhile, and we have the different techniques, which we are going to discuss later on, to ablate these tumors or eradicate them, that okay. we can survive them longer time.
There are actually some recommendations that are being developed by the liver societies, both in Europe and here. So if you know that you have some of the risk factor, maybe you're infected with hepatitis B, or you had hepatitis B, you know, then you should look for the presence of liver cancer by periodic imaging, even if you're not cirrhotic. If you are hepatitis C, or you have overweight, or you know you're drinking, then your doctor should try to understand when and if your disease is becoming chronic and cirrhotic, because from that point on, the risk of developing a cancer is 5%. Per year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And therefore, we don't call it screening, but oncologic surveillance. But an oncologic surveillance, at least with alpha fetoprotein and an ultrasound every 6 months, is warranted. That's the only thing that lets you find the cancer still in a treatable stage.
Okay. Well, great. Why don't we hold on that for a moment? It's time for us to take a medical minute. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here in the studio this evening with Dr. Sukru Emre and Mario Strasobosko.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before, thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm joined this evening by Dr. Sukru Emre and Mario Strasobosco from the Yale Cancer Center, and we're here talking about the approach and treatment evaluation of patients with liver cancer. And before the break, we were talking about how important it is to have very careful follow-up of patients who have chronic liver disease. And Mario, I'll start with you. I guess who would be the key person to kind of, you know, oversee, you know, the follow-up of that patient with chronic liver disease? Is it the primary care physician, or would it be someone like yourself who is a liver specialist, also known as a hepatologist?
This can be done by other. The primary physician should know that the patient with advanced liver disease should be screened every 6 months for the presence of liver cancer, as we said earlier, with an ultrasound of the abdomen and the liver and a tumor marker, which is called alpha fetoprotein. However, I would recommend to send to the hepatologist patient that are known to have liver disease, because we actually have designed our practice and our clinic to take care of this aspect. It's sometimes not very easy to understand when is the moment in which chronic hepatitis actually becomes liver cirrhosis, which is something much more severe, but can happen without any symptom at all. It's something that changes in your liver and will not show clinically for a long time, but the risk that come with this evolution, that may or may not happen. Less than 20% of the patients that are infected with hepatitis C actually develop a cirrhosis. So there's a lot that your hepatologist or your primary care physician can do before to prevent the cirrhosis, and when you are cirrhotic, to understand what risk it is.
Okay. So once liver cancer is diagnosed, so what's the process that is involved in terms of, you know, staging the patient to see whether or not it's local, confined to liver, or it's spread, and then, you know, what are the different stages of liver cancer? Maybe Sukru, you can kind of help us with that.
When we diagnose the tumor, we always look at whether we have any. First of all, the size of the tumor is really important, and in order to staging the tumor. And the second thing is number of the tumors, really important. Third thing is whether, you know, the tumor is opening the any major vessels, and the another parameter we look at it. And also we look at whether any tumor outside of the liver, and that includes and lymph nodes around the liver, bones and the lungs, and we have to check whether we have any lesions there or not. So based on that, looking at the size of the tumor, we stage the tumors to four stages. Stage one is tumor less than 2 centimeters and one tumor. If there's more than one tumor and the sizes and all the less than 3 centimeters, three tumors, and or one tumor size up to 5 centimeters, that will give us the stage two or T2 criteria, what we talk about. The stage three and this stage they may indicate that the cancer is composed of several large tumors, or cancer may be one large tumor that has grown to invade the liver's main veins or to invade nearby structures such as the gallbladder. And stage four tumors that the liver cancer has spread beyond the liver to other areas of the body. So that the 1 to 4, we stage the tumors.
And Mario, what are the different treatment options that are available to us? You know, once the liver cancer is diagnosed, once the staging evaluation has been done?
The treatment option actually depends really strictly on the stage of the tumor. And this is a very peculiar tumor because, different from many others, it's a tumor in a failing organ. So there are oncologic criteria, but also functional criteria. The liver of the cirrhotic patient is not working very well. So that is a big limitation to the amount of options that you have. So when we stage the disease, we try to combine the oncologic extension of the disease, which means size, number, metastasis, with the assessment of the function of the liver. Okay, so every doctor, when sees a patient like with tumor, goes through a center, you know, mental flowchart. Mm-hmm. And first of all, he asks himself, is this patient cirrhotic? Yes or not? Because whether the patient is cirrhotic or not, as Sukru will explain later, there's a dramatic change in your option of what you do. And secondly, can the tumor be resected by the surgeon? And if it's not, what kind of alternative treatment the patient can sustain? Mm-hmm. And this really depends on the function of the liver. For example, you may have a small tumor that could be addressed by different means, but in a patient whose functional status is so compromised that your only option, as Tucker will explain later, is actually to transplant the liver. On the other hand, you may have a patient with a little bit larger tumor and a very well preserved function, and this patient would maybe could be better served by resection eventually or other intervention. Mm-hmm. So this is the assessment that is made every time, and is assessment that requires multiple competence. That's why all these patients are actually discussed in a multidisciplinary board that includes hepatologists, surgeons, transplant surgeons, surgical oncology, pathology, medical oncologist. All these competences actually are gathered and discussed to the specific of each case.
So at Yale, Zucker, maybe just to expand on a little bit. So when you see a patient newly diagnosed with liver cancer, you have this entire team of doctors that Mari was just discussing to kind of provide their individual expertise perspectives and then to come up with a game plan for the patient.
That's right. You know, the if I expedite a little bit more, our multidisciplinary cancer, liver cancer meeting, we have diagnostic radiologists, intervention radiologists, hepatologists, and the medical oncologists, surgeons, and the and social workers, coordinators, and support staff as well. We meet together. In each case, it was is discussed in details, and then the options are discussed. And again, you know, just if someone with a very minimal liver reserve, and the tumor is located middle of the liver, and resection may not be a good option. On the other hand, if patient has a good liver reserve, what we call child A cirrhosis or compensated liver cirrhosis, and the favorably located tumor, then resection might be an option. And here, the other option we should talk about that the are interventional radiologists, and mm-hmm. they do other ablation techniques. One technique, what we call radiofrequency ablation, in a way, an ultrasound-guided approach, and we get into the tumor, and that we can create and a very high heat in the tumor with the that we can cook the tumor or we can freeze the tumor, but these are different techniques. Or we can, our interventional radiologists travel through the via the vessels, and they get into the either femoral vein or arm veins, and arteries. Then they travel through the arteries and get into the liver artery, feeding the liver, and even get close to the tumor where the tumor is, that we can deliver high doses of chemotherapy in the tumor, and then we knock down the vessels, arteries feeding the tumor, that we can shrink the tumor down, and that we can keep the tumor in the liver. These are the techniques we use. Which techniques we are going to use? Again, this is a multidisciplinary approach.
So, Sukra, maybe since you're obviously an expert in liver transplantation, when do you typically consider transplantation as a reasonable treatment option for patients with liver cancer.
So that they are for transplantation, and there are two ways to look at it. And if we have a patient with a single tumor, we control with this ablation techniques. And after ablation treatment, if there is no tumor in the liver, there's no reason to transplant the patient. And that's number one. The second issue is there's a tumor in the liver, and also there's a cirrhosis and the liver disease. The organ allocation system in the United States at this point allocates the organ based on the severity of the liver disease. Meanwhile, we develop the rules for hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer patients. If cancer meets the what we call T2 criteria, which I explained before, and I will say it again, and which means that one tumor less than between 2 to 5 centimeters, or up to 3 tumors, and the 3 tumors, then they should be less than 3 centimeters in diameter. This is the definition of T2 criteria. Then those individuals, they will assign and 22 melt points. Then every 3 months, and they accrue and 3 more points. And eventually, their points will go 22, 25, 28, and 31, and they will get the liver organ offers. Okay. And I would like to say one thing. It's really important because it's a very complex topic. Organs are allocated to patients directly based on MELD score. MELD stands for Medical End Stage Liver Disease Scoring System. So that you may have your liver tumor, if your liver tumor is more than T2 criteria, and probably you may not get the liver transplant through this UNOS system. Those cases, living donor liver transplantation will be a great option for the patients and get the transplant done timely. Saving the lives.
Okay, great. So Mario, so we've seen a lot of, I think, advances in the treatment of liver cancer over the years. You've obviously been involved. Maybe you can just, in the minute and a half we have left, tell us a little bit about how things really have evolved.
Right. Yeah, this is an important question because it lets us also give some good news to our patients. I mean, the treatment of liver cancer has changed dramatically in the last 10, 15 years. And what was previously a death diagnosis is now a diagnosis with which you can live many years, depending on the stage of the diagnosis, of course, but also multiple approaches we have. First of all, transplant is now one of the options. It wasn't 10 years ago. Our interventional radiologists are always continuously refining the approach that they can offer to our patient, and they can use embolization with a radioactive material, drug-eluting beads. I don't know if we have the time to go into the details for each of those. And lastly, the last development in the last 2-3 years has been the application of biological drugs, meaning compounds that can block certain specific signaling mechanism that drives the growth of the tumor. There are many of these drugs in the pipeline, as we say, and will be and are available to the patients. And we put great hope in those new non-chemotherapeutic oncologic drugs.
Great. Well, you know, it's amazing how quickly the time has gone, and we'll obviously have to have both of you come back, and so we can discuss more, you know, really how far we've come in terms of treatment of patients with liver cancer. So thank you so much for joining us this evening. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Zemre and Strasabosco, for joining us this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have any questions or would like to share your comments, you can go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.